Well, there's a new book that was released late last year. It's titled, Does Putin Have to Die? The Story of How Russia Becomes a Democracy After Losing to Ukraine. And it's a fascinating book written by Ilya Ponomarev and Greg Stebbin. And we are joined today by Greg, one of the authors of this book. Greg, thank you for coming on and speaking with us.
Oh, it's really my pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So, Greg, there's a lot of different topics and subjects that are explored in this book. And first off, I want to point out that Ilya Ponomarev is becoming an increasingly well-known name for those that are really delving into the intricacies of the Russia-Ukraine war, because he was the only person in the Russian parliament that defected against the Crimean invasion and was also a very outspoken critic of Putin. So I want to just start with that there. And obviously, he is one of the authors of the book along with you. So let's just start in terms of discussing how you and Ilya ended up coming about to write this book. What was the genesis of it in the first place?
Yeah, and let me build on his background a little bit, because I think a lot of people didn't think about the Russian form of government and how things work there a year ago as deeply as they do now because of, obviously, the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So Ilya Ponomarev was a member of the Russian parliament. He was, in 2014, the only member of the Russian parliament to vote against the annexation of Crimea. And that is a very, very important part of the story and a very important part of the genesis of this book, Does Putin Have to Die? He voted against the annexation of Crimea. And look, in that system, which is autocratic, when you oppose the leader, there can be some serious consequences. So as his reward for voting against Putin on Crimea and being the only one to vote against him, Ilya was put on the kill list and remains there to this day. He'll jokingly say, you know, I keep a machine gun by my door. And that is not hyperbole. That is true. You know, when you're talking with him, many of his stories involve people that at the end of the story is he's dead now. And the implication is he's dead now for being a political opponent of Putin. So this is very serious stuff. And it was a very courageous thing that he did when he opposed the annexation of Crimea. And Ilya said at the time, and very publicly, you can go watch him on the BBC or US news channels. He said at the time, if this annexation happens, it will lead to a full-scale invasion of Ukraine by Russia. And he also said, if Russia ever invades Ukraine, I will fight on the side of Ukraine. This was part of his immediate reaction and his justification for opposing the annexation of Crimea. He was, shortly after the annexation, so back in 2014, forced out of the country. So he has not been back to Russia since 2014. He lived in the U.S. for several years. He's a very Western guy. He very much understands who we are, how we live, our way of life. He loves our way of life. He loves the West. He's a capitalist. He's a very successful business guy. He, when he was forced out of Russia, lived in Silicon Valley for a couple of years. When he was in the parliament, his district was considered the Silicon Valley of Russia. So even as a member of the Russian parliament, he spent a lot of time in the U.S. in Silicon Valley and in Austin, tech hub, Boston, tech hub in New York. And in fact, just as a side note, to kind of give you a sense of, you know, who he is as a person, he was the first person in Ukraine. He's now a Ukrainian citizen and lives there. His company, a Ukrainian company, was the first company ever to go public in the U.S. So he's a Russian through and through, but also is very much like you and I. He understands capitalism. He loves the Western way of life. And to get to back to the subtitle of the book, The Story of How Russia Becomes a Democracy After Losing to Ukraine, he wants his fellow Russians to be able to live the way you and I do. So he is not anti-Russian in his opposing Putin in this invasion. He's anti-Putin.
Yeah, and he has a really impressive background. And I mean, all the stuff that he had done for Russia, even prior to his public service, serving in the parliament, is pretty impressive. I mean, I was just looking at some of the things that he was involved with. I mean, it's a very long list of accomplishments. Like you said, you know, this strong business background, technical, scientific background. He was deeply involved, even with just trying to make sure that Russia was going to be more successful, the most innovative, yes, kind of replicating what we see in Silicon Valley there in Russia. And, you know, so he was deeply involved even with the West and other countries in forming partnerships, even with MIT and, you know, trying to establish some type of academic research exchange. And so there's a lot of stuff that he was doing. And then he moved into parliament, like you said, from when was it, 2007 to 2006?
He was elected in for the first time in 2007. That's correct.
2007 to 2016.
Yeah, and let me stop you there for a minute, because if you do some math, you come up with something really interesting. He opposed the annexation of Crimea in 2014. He was put on the kill list and thrown out of the country in 2014. He continued to serve in the Duma until 2016. He was serving in the Duma from California. Can you imagine the House of Representatives in the U.S. forcing a member out of the country, and then the member of the House of Representatives in exile is still serving? That was the level of his commitment to his country.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, opposing Putin is not good for, well, your self-interest. Let's just put it that way.
let's say longevity.
Yes.
I think it is good for your self-interest, but it may not be good for your longevity.
Yeah. For one point, it was like every single month, there was another wealthy Russian oligarch that mysteriously dying, either being thrown out a window, falling out of a window, quote unquote, falling out of a window, or even families being killed. So clearly, I mean, like you said, he's put on this hit list, this kill list. He was probably seeing a number of different colleagues and people that he worked with, because he was deeply involved in a lot of these different areas that were being killed off. So his life was at stake. And now my understanding is he's actually receiving protection from Ukraine because he's living in Ukraine, in Kyiv.
That's right. I think he moved to Kyiv in 2016. I think he became a citizen. Well, I don't remember what year, but he's now a Ukrainian citizen. And again, don't hear that as a betrayal of his country. He became a citizen of Ukraine because the leadership of his country rejected him. So he is very pro-Russian. He wants Russia to be a strong, thriving nation with a democratic government. But he is at the moment a citizen of Ukraine because he can't go back to Russia. And yes, the Ukrainian government provides him with security. One of the things we have not discussed in depth, because generally our conversations revolve around the invasion itself and what he is doing in the face of the invasion, and I hope we'll spend some time talking about that. I'm not sure how it came to be that the Ukrainian government began to provide him with security, but I can tell you that a lot of exiled Russians went to Ukraine and they were being killed. So I think the Ukrainian government, for whatever reason, saw it in the best interest of their own security and longevity to protect these people when they proved to be loyal to Ukraine. And Ilya is a very, very loyal and respected member of Ukrainian society. And he also has very, very deep relationships and meaningful relationships with members of the Ukrainian government. Again, we haven't discussed it at length, but I think the Ukrainian government gets a lot of deep insights and understandings about Russia and Putin from Ilya and other Russians who have now been forced to live in other places and have chosen Ukraine as their place to live.
Yeah, and just to be clear, I mean, from what he states, he's not anti-Russian by any means. He's just anti-Putin. He does not like...
He's anti-dictatorship, if you read, you know, yeah, if you want to elevate it, and Putin happens to represent dictatorship in his country today.
Right. So he has nothing against Russia and the Russian people. In fact, again, as we discussed earlier, I mean, he did everything that he could during his life and even serving in parliament to make sure that Russia was successful.
Yes.
In becoming, you know, innovative, a place where people wanted to do business and forming relationships with lots of different countries. So this is, again, it's against his efforts are aimed at really stopping Putin and against dictatorships in general, as he makes clear. So nothing against Russia itself. Let's talk about where you fit into this, because my understanding is that he had written a book previously about his experiences years back, and this was like a 700 page book. It was very in Russian, right? And you used Google Translate to read it and then basically had kind of convinced him, hey, we need to do a more summarized version and updated given what we see now with the war. So tell us where you kind of fit into this.
Yeah. So part of what I want to make clear here is about myself, and this is very much not about me, but my role, I think, is useful. When Russia invaded Ukraine in February of 2022, like a lot of people around the world, I felt the repercussions of this were so severe, the potential repercussions. One of the areas where I was very, very concerned in the next day after the beginning of the invasion of Ukraine by Russia or within the next week, I was afraid that China might invade Taiwan and that this might actually be a concerted effort. And can you imagine how much chaos in the world there would be if these two nations had both begun this kind of action at the same time? How would the rest of the world respond to that? Mm-hmm. I'm happy to say that hasn't happened. I do believe that China is watching what happened with Russia and Ukraine, you know, as like a canary in the coal mine. Can we get away with this? And I think that, you know, and my suspicion is between the leadership of China and the leadership of Russia, you know, Russia's kind of the little brother. And it's like Xi Jinping said, you know, Putin, you go try it. Let's see how it works.
Testing the waters.
Yeah, and sort of like the big brother sends the little brother to go do the stupid thing. And then if it doesn't work out so well, the big brother knows he shouldn't do it too. I think that there's an element in their relationship. But let's leave that aside. I was very upset about the invasion. I wondered what I could do when Ukraine launched its search for soldiers to join their territorial defense. I investigated that. I knew that I was not suitable to be a soldier on behalf of Ukraine. I have no military background and I'm a little old to be doing that. But I wanted to serve. And how I discovered that I could help was by going to Warsaw. I spent a month there in March and April and made some incursions, light incursions into Ukraine. There was not into a war zone because I didn't want to put myself in a position where I became a problem for my government or the Ukrainian government. But I went there to report on what was happening there and to raise money. Many, many, many people like me did the same thing and continue to do the same thing. And I encourage you to support those people. In the course of doing that, through friends, I met Ilya. I began to understand what his goals were, which is really what the subtitle of the book leads to, the story of how Russia becomes a democracy after losing to Ukraine. Those are two really important things, and I want both to happen. I want Ukraine to be victorious, and I want Russia to become a democracy as a result. You know, people will say to me, do you really think Russia is going to lose this war? And I say, no, I don't think Russia is going to lose. I think Russia is going to win, but I don't think they're going to win the war. I think Ukraine's going to win the war and Russia's going to become a democracy. And that's a win for both. So I want to be really clear about that. I met Ilya and I began to understand that what his goal was in fighting on behalf of Ukraine, his goal was to form a new democratic government for Russia. And he is literally in the process of doing that now. In fact, about 2 months ago, I went back to Warsaw where he was holding a constitutional convention with other exiled Russian politicians to begin forming a new government. They've written a new constitution. They're writing new laws, starting with freedom of speech, which is essential if you want to live in a dictatorship versus an autocratic government or a dictatorship. And they're literally forming a new government, all made up of delegates of previously elected in legitimate elections, unlike Putin. He was not currently elected in a legitimate election. These delegates are forming a new government so that when Putin is gone, the Russian people know that a new government has been formed transparently and can go to Moscow and take power.
So Ilya is really, I would say, it sounds like one of the central figures in opposition to Putin. Again, just to establish some of the facts here, you know, yes. He served in the parliament from 2007 to 2016. He was the only person that opposed the annexation of Crimea, and he was a vocal critic of the war, fled for his life. He is now living in Ukraine.
Well, here's what happened. He was a member of the parliament. It was a few months after the vote on Crimea. He, as a member of the parliament representing the district, which is like the Silicon Valley of Russia, he spent a lot of time in California and other U.S. tech hubs trying to get companies to bring, you know, research and development or production to his district in Russia. So he was in Silicon Valley on official Duma business. He goes to a series of meetings. He goes to sleep. He wakes up in the morning and his phone is full of messages. And he begins reading the texts and listening to the messages. And his phone rings and it's a reporter from a Russian newspaper. And the reporter says, "Have you seen the headlines? Read them and call me back." And he goes to his computer and he clicks on the news in Russian and he finds out two things. Overnight while he was sleeping, the first thing that happened was he was murdered.
At least okay. That's what the news was saying. The Russian state news, yes.
Yeah, exactly. And he was murdered. Here's the crazy part. He was murdered by Crimeans. Now, why would Crimeans kill him? He was the only one that defended them. But as absurd as it is, he's reading in the news that he's dead.
That just goes into a real interesting side note. We don't need to go there now, of just Russian propaganda in and of itself.
Exactly. So, and on top of that, not only is he dead because he was murdered by Ukrainians or Crimeans, he's also been forced into exile and cannot return to Russia. So the Russian government, even though that he's dead, says he can't come back. That's pretty interesting. But he's reading this and he realizes, what do I do? The dead part's not a problem. I know I'm not dead. I'm pinching myself, right? But I can't go home. I have a wife and children. He grabs his phone and his ATM card, because he's looking at his wallet and he has $21. He runs to an ATM. It's his state Duma ATM card. You know, it's the money in his ATM account comes from his salary. What do you think's happened to his ATM card? It's dead. He calls his wife to make sure she and his kids are safe. And what are the, you know, he's got to move them. He's got to get them out of there. It's a Duma cell phone. The phone is dead. So he didn't flee Russia. He went on official business to make Russia a better place and build relationships and bring jobs to Russia. And he was forced out of the country. And the point I want to make about this, because it is absolutely one of my favorite parts of the book, is he says in the book, you know, I'm standing on a street corner. I don't have enough money to pay for another night in a hotel. So I've got to run back and check out and walk out on the street again with my suitcase and my computer bag. And I have nowhere to go. And not enough money for a hotel room, and my phone is dead. And he says, you know what? You may think it was one of the worst moments of my life, but once I got someone to lend me a phone, a friend to give me a phone, and like to connect with my wife and make sure she and my kids were safe, it was not one of the worst days of my life, but it was one of the best days of my life because I was free. And then he goes on to talk about how many other Russians of companies you and I know and love get to enjoy the freedom of living in a place like the United States of America under a system of democracy and capitalism, and that he was finally, for the first time in his life, free to do the same thing. And then he lists some of those companies, and we forget the founders of Google are from Russia. The founder of WhatsApp, or Evernote and WhatsApp, I think, are from Russia. He goes on to list all these Russians who were able to break free from the tyranny of Russia, came to the United States or went somewhere else in the West and suddenly became free. And he says, that's when I became the greatest evangelist for freedom and capitalism and democracy.
Now, let's talk about some of the Russian reporting around Ilya for a moment here, because if you do look, you know, there's some reports about embezzling money and there's been quite a bit of a campaign against him. Obviously,
yes.
As we've noted many times now, he was the only person that voted no against the Crimean annexation in 2014, warned very openly that this would lead to a wider Ukrainian invasion. And he opposed Putin openly, which is something you never want to do if you value your own life. There has been a pretty aggressive campaign against him in Russia. And as you noted, you know, when he was in the U.S. on business, they declared that he was killed, which is sending a very strong message that you're about to die. And especially right. If you try to come back here, this is the message. This is the official message that we're telling everyone now. So his life was already in danger at that point. So let's talk about some of the Russian points that have been made about him.
Well, you brought up corruption charges of corruption. And his side of the story is very similar to other stories where people get accused of corruption because a corrupt system has accused them of corruption so that the system can continue to remain in power. He, even before he became a member of the State Duma, was very involved in building a series of, they call them tech parks in Russia, really tech parks all over, particularly Eastern Europe. These were pieces of real estate that were created literally from scratch, created tech hubs, you know, and incubators, we might call them in the US. You know, lots of universities have tech incubators to draw companies, to draw talented people, and to draw capital. And Ilya was in charge, even before he was in the Duma, of building a very, very successful set of these tech parks all over Russia. It was actually in collaboration with MIT. He created that relationship with MIT. It was an incredibly successful thing for Russia. I don't remember the exact statistic. It's in the book, but at one point he says, the second or third largest country in the world for drawing venture capital as a result of creating these tech hubs was Russia. I mean, it began to transform the country's economy, its relationship with nations around the world economically. It was having a great impact on young population. They saw that, you know, there was a great future of starting a company or working for a company in Russia. He was like creating this incredible national initiative backed up with infrastructure. And unfortunately, two things happened. The first is, because he became a problem politically, charges of corruption were trumped up against him. Again, I'm telling you his side of the story, and it's in the book. He makes a very strong case, and I believe him because I know him well, that everything he was accused of was sort of like him being murdered in Crimea. You know, it was a bunch of propaganda because there was a larger motive at stake for the government itself. And he even talks about a conversation he had with Putin about these charges after the charges were resolved and went away. So that's where the corruption charges went. But, you know, of course, things stick with you, right? So when people read about Ilya, one of the things they read about is these corruption charges. He was cleared of those charges. Later, they began to come up again as a weapon against him.
I think that's part of what led him into parliament as well, right?
His career as a business person is really interesting. He started his first business and I believe exited successfully while he was in high school, started another business, then I think while he was in college. And then after he went and got a degree in physics, he was hired to work for a company called Yukos. Yukos at the time was the largest oil and gas company in Russia. Led by a man named Michael Khodorkovsky, who plays a significant role in this story then and now. I'm going to give you a little background on Michael Khodorkovsky, just because it's so relevant to what's happening today. At one point, Khodorkovsky was the richest man in Russia because he led the largest oil and gas company in Russia. Forbes put him at number 16 on the richest people in the world list, so he was the 16th richest person in the world. He was Ilya's mentor as a young business person. And Khodorkovsky was very interested in technology and the internet very early on in the early stages of the internet. And that's how Ilya became a technologist, which of course led him to be the member of the Duma representing the Silicon Valley of Russia. It really stemmed from that first job, although he had already been a successful entrepreneur and playing with technology and computers and things. But that really, you know, gave him the kind of successful background of business and enterprise at scale to begin to build businesses himself. But Khodorkovsky, just his background, 16th richest person in the world, the richest person in Russia, opposed Putin as well and spent 10 years in prison because of it. Guess what? Corruption charges, just like Ilya, right? Trumped up corruption charges. The richest man in your country, and he spent 10 years in prison, in a Russian prison, because of it. And I bring him up now because of the significant role he played in Ilya's life and development as a young man. But also today, when you talk about Russian opposition, there's really four main figures. There's Ilya, there's Michael Khodorkovsky, there's Garry Kasparov, the chess master, and of course, there's Navalny, who's in prison. Those are really, when you talk about Russian opposition, the four main players. And by the way, They all know each other. They've all worked together because they've all been opposing Putin for a long, 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 long time. And that gives you some context of Putin opposition and where it is today.
So there's a very interesting series of events that led Ilya from becoming a successful tech entrepreneur and businessman to joining the Russian parliament. It seems like Ilya was seeing and believing that after the fall of the Soviet Union, Russia had a brighter future ahead of it, and that it could be, if not a significant participant, perhaps even leader in technological developments, the internet, and burgeoning media platforms out of the internet. Unfortunately, this was not the vision or direction that the Russian government under Putin was heading, and so he ultimately joined the parliament to try and influence things in a more pro-democratic, pro-capitalist direction. So tell us about how all this played out, because this is a really interesting part of the book.
So he was working for Yukos, Michael Khodorkovsky, originally in oil and gas, and then on the technology side. This is very early in the age of the internet. And then he went out on his own and was working for a company that had developed an interactive TV platform. And we're talking over 20 years ago. This was very, very early advanced stuff. And his company, this interactive TV platform, had gone to the capital markets, was arranging financing, and their lead investor was Ted Turner. And around the time that Turner was scheduled to come to Moscow to sign the papers and, you know, actually give the money to the company to fund it, was around the same time that Putin began to crack down on independent media. And so Putin's crackdown on independent media obviously scared investors like Ted Turner away. I mean, that was the end of the company. You're not going to raise money to build a TV platform in a country where you don't have free press. So Ilya watched what happened when the government executed bad policy, like cracking down on independent media. He saw what that meant to him and his company. And he said, you know what? I don't ever want this to happen to me again. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm going to always be an entrepreneur. I don't want the government getting in my way. And I don't want the government ever to get in anybody's way. And that really was the birth of him thinking about a life in the political arena. And again, as I said, you know, one of the ways he executed on that vow to stop the government from hurting entrepreneurs was to sign on to become the leader of these tech parks, which happened before he was member of the Duma. But of course, the success of those tech parks until Putin killed the initiative was that it launched him into the Duma. And by the way, the whole initiative of the tech parks was very, very successful. As I said, you know, a relationship with MIT, raising was the second or third most successful country in the world for raising venture capital. But that all came to an end after the annexation of Crimea, because all the young people realized this was a terrible place to start a company, and they fled the country. You know, they've had a huge brain drain for a long time in Russia, but it was really exasperated by the annexation of Crimea, because young people in Russia realized, if I want to have any freedom and success in the world, I got to get out of here.
Well, and I was reading reports. This is actually even produced by Russian official sources. It's saying just how many millions of people have fled Russia that perhaps were even outside of Russia prior to the invasion that never came back, or right, even right immediately following the invasion that fled. I mean, millions and millions of Russians have left, and many of them are unfortunately the exact people that you want to keep.
Yeah, if you left, I'm going to overgeneralize here, obviously, because we're talking about, you know, millions of people, but the people most able to leave were going to be the best and the brightest, because they knew they could go somewhere else and thrive, and had the resources, because they were the best and brightest inside of Russia, had the resources to leave and the contacts. So they had the money, they had the contacts, they knew they could move their company or get jobs somewhere else. So they left. And what Putin has done long before the invasion of Crimea, but because of his autocratic policies, is he's chased away the absolute best people that you need to make a country thrive.
Yeah, so here's a link given what I was mentioning. This is the FSB, and so that's the, let me just check real quick, Russia's Federal Security Service. So they reported actually after the invasion that in the first 3 months of 2022, a total of 3,880,679 Russians traveled for work, business, tourism, and that they have not returned. So, you know, there was some concern about how do we get these people back? And they show that most of them fled, like you said, to Ukraine. We're living in Ukraine, but Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Armenia, and the list goes on and on. But this is the state, you know, Russian, I don't know what you would call the FSB, their state security service, admitting that millions, 4 million Russians have left Russia.
And that's millions of people after the millions that left since Putin took power and at the turn of the century.
Yeah. Yeah. So again, what we're discussing here is Ilya Ponomarev. He was a very successful tech entrepreneur, forming all of these partnerships with different parts of the world, particularly in the West and Silicon Valley, to try to bolster Russia's innovation. And, you know, he was seeing this slow slide towards what he calls in the book Putinism, you know, Russian fascism. Again, he's not anti-Russian by any means. It was the Putin in power and the government that he was setting up, consolidating his power for his own self-interest versus the good for the Russian people as he saw it. And this was a major reason why he voted against the annexation of Crimea, because he was worried that once that happens, then that is going to alienate Russia. It's going to make it much harder for people to even want to do business with Russia, which he felt firsthand, as you mentioned, with, you know, Ted Turner pulling back. So moving against all the efforts that he's trying to do. And the foreword in the book is actually a speech from Vladimir Putin, which also fits into this. So tell us a little bit about, you know, where Putin started out and where we are today.
You know, often when I'm talking to people about this book or the situation in Russia, you know, people will say to me, do you think Russia can be a democracy? Or can the Russian people, do they want to live in a democracy? Are they capable of living in a democracy? But there's a lot of evidence that shows, I think even today, that the Russian people are trapped in this dysfunctional system of, they've been fed propaganda for years and years and years. They don't have a view of the world that we do. And look, you know, we're fed propaganda too, but at least we can go pick and choose what propaganda to create our own well-rounded view of the world if we choose to. They don't have that freedom. So a lot of people say the Russian people are incapable of being free and thinking for themselves. They want to be ruled by a strong man. Well, I say bunk to that, frankly, because Putin himself wanted Russia to be a democracy. And if Putin believed at the beginning of his reign of power that Russia could be a democracy, how am I going to argue with that? So as you said, the introduction or the foreword of the book is actually a speech Vladimir Putin gave a couple of weeks after 9/11 about how Russia was going to be transformed under his leadership to be a democracy, to be a very, very strong partner to the West, about why human rights were so important. I mean, you read this speech. By the way, I got this speech from the Russian government's website. This speech really happened. I've met one of the people who helped write this speech and was there when it was delivered. It really happened. It's not some trumped up piece of propaganda. It really happened. And if you didn't know who gave this speech and someone handed it to you, it is so pro-democracy, pro-capitalism, pro-West, you might think to yourself, is this a speech that Ronald Reagan gave? No, it's a speech that Vladimir Putin gave about his own country, Russia. Now, we could have a whole other long conversation about how he went from being so pro-democracy to where he is today. And I'm happy to have that conversation. I don't know that I'm the most authoritative person, but the point is, if Putin believed that Russia could be a democracy, I believe that Russia could be a democracy. I don't think it's going to be easy, but I do think it's possible. And I think that someone or some group of people just has to stand for it and lead the people there with strong leadership and transparency.
Yeah, and unfortunately, now we're at the point where if you oppose Putin openly, if you criticize him, then you are either in exile or you die a mysterious death. And there's been you know, now I'm not sure what the number is, if it's 10, 15 different people that have been killed in Russia, some of which did openly oppose Putin or even just called it a war instead of a special military operation. Right. So, you know, that's a sad state of affairs when, you know, when you oppose the leader and you're mysteriously killed, in some cases your entire family killed. I mean, if you look at the Russian reporting around this, they're almost always labeled as suicides, or you know that these people went crazy and killed their family. But when this happens over and over again, it's a pattern, right? And
there is a joke in Russia. The oligarch goes to check in a hotel, and they say, "Oh, we have a. Would you like a nice room with a view?" No. I mean, so many oligarchs have fallen out of windows. I think if you're a dictator, there's always this kind of shroud of mystery that you have to create around yourself so that we all know that all these oligarchs are not jumping out of windows, but we don't have proof. So if you're a dictator, that's kind of the way you want it, because your ultimate goal is to keep people afraid and in line. And when you start killing people and pushing them out of windows and in other ways, people begin to fall in line, except for those who were brave enough to speak out, like Ilya Ponomarev, like Michael Khodorkovsky, like Garry Kasparov, and Navalny, who's in prison.
So as you said, those who have vocally opposed Putin have ended up in jail. They've been poisoned, killed, or in the case of Ilya, forced to live in exile and now trying to set up a completely separate government of Russians also living in exile, which is just fascinating. And when it comes to all the wealthy Russian businessmen that were killed month after month for most of last year, I often try to explain this in terms that might be a bit more relatable to us in the U.S. is, imagine you had a whole bunch of the most wealthy and successful business people in the U.S. mysteriously dying one after another every single month, and in some cases their entire families being killed along with them because some of them decided to oppose Biden or the U.S. government. I mean, it would be similar to Biden and the Biden administration becoming so militant and aggressive in its war against fossil fuels that it just starts killing off many of the leaders in the oil and gas industry one by one, including their families, until everyone gets in line and dares not criticize the government or Biden himself. I mean, Greg, that's what we saw in Russia nearly all of last year with these mysterious deaths, month after month.
Right. And, you know, we happen to be living in some pretty contentious times, right? I mean, feelings for Trump, very strong pro, very strong con. Feelings for Biden, very strong pro, very strong con. People, as a rule, have not died for holding their views about whoever is the current president of the United States. And you can sit in a restaurant and talk about it if you want.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't have to be afraid about what you say. Let's talk about the title of the book, Does Putin Have to Die? Mm-hmm. What is the answer to that?
Yeah, you cannot write a book called Does Putin Have to Die and not answer the question. That would be the ultimate red herring. I'm going to tell you Ilya's position on this, and it's in the book, obviously. Before I do, I want to quote someone else who answered a similar question about it, because I think the answer is brilliant. President Zelensky was asked in an interview, not exactly the question, does Putin have to die? But I think in the interview he was asked, you know, what do you think should happen to Putin after Ukraine is victorious? And I love what President Zelensky said, because there's so many layers underneath it. But when asked what he thought should happen to Putin after the war was over and Ukraine was victorious, his answer was, I don't care. And I love that as an answer, because what it means is that Putin becomes insignificant in the scheme of things. And in his answer, I don't care, there is no need to exert revenge. And I'm not speaking for Ukrainians or the West or anything. I just know from personal experience that when you're fighting for what's right, and I do believe that Ukraine is right, and I do believe that Russia is wrong, but when you're fighting for what's right, if you're distracted by the urge to extract revenge, your argument for being right is now dirtied, it's sullied. It's much better to be focused on the righteous goal than the need to extract revenge. And so I love that Zelensky said that. I'll tell you how Ilya answers that question in the book. And that is that, and I believe this as well. We spent a lot of time talking about it. I believe the answer to the question, does Putin have to die, is up to Putin. The Ukrainians are not going to kill him because the Ukrainians are not going to have a chance to kill him. Would they kill him? Well, I think it's pretty obvious that if someone invades your country and you can kill the leader, you kill the leader. That's obvious, right? But I don't think the Ukrainians are ever going to have a chance. I think Putin either leaves today or tomorrow or next week and has enough money and enough power to go somewhere, live in exile, and afford the greatest security in the world to make sure that he lives and his family, if he wants to take his family, live forever fairly safely and securely, or he stays on the same path he's on, and someone around him kills him. If Putin dies, other than natural causes, if he's killed, he's going to be killed by a Russian. And it's probably going to be somebody who is very well known to him. And why do I say that? Why does Ilya say that? Well, he has now become a threat to the people around him. He talks about nukes. Well, if I'm a close aide, that's not the world I want to die in. I got to kill this guy to protect myself. He's also got a lot of people around him who have a lot of dirt to keep buried. Well, the longer Putin stays in power, the more vulnerable they are for being exposed. So to protect myself, I got to kill him. And so if Putin dies unnaturally, look to a Russian to do it. And it's going to be probably out of self-defense. But I do think that he does not have to die. I think he can leave, but he better do it soon.
So the worry is, and this is something that's been coming up in the media a little bit more, is that if Putin does die, or if he's forced out of power, whatever the circumstances may be, that the person behind him could actually be worse than him.
Worse. Yes. 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 I mean, if Putin is gone suddenly, there's three options, right? You're going to get another Putin. You're going to get someone who's worse than Putin, or you're going to get somebody who is a member of the Russian opposition or a group of members of the Russian opposition who want Russia to become part of the rest of the Western world. You know, a democracy, a country with freedom, a country with a capitalist economic system, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I read an interesting article last week. I don't remember who wrote it, but he was talking about the nature of dictatorship. And he was explaining different types of dictatorships. You know, the dictatorship in China is very different than the dictatorship in Russia. In Russia, there is what this writer called a personal dictatorship. Everything revolves around Putin. It's all designed for the longevity of Putin. And the people around him are all there to serve him and his personal interests. There is no longer in Russia a government with institutions. You know, in China, it's a dictatorship, but it's a structural dictatorship, right? I mean, if Xi Jinping is gone, the government is still intact. It just needs a new leader. That's not what's happened in Russia. In Russia, Putin has built a government that all revolves around him. And people of strength are not there anymore because people of strength are a threat to him. So anybody around him, anyone running any other part of the government, is weaker than him because he doesn't want people around him who are stronger than him. He's threatened by them. So when he's gone, the entire structure of the government falls apart. There is no government. There's just Putin. So if he's gone tomorrow, and let's say someone who is like Putin or worse than Putin tries to take over the government, there's no government to take over. They have to start over. Now, I'm not saying they couldn't be successful, but it's not going to be easy. I'm also not saying it's not going to happen, but probably what's going to happen if Putin is gone and you have a Putin-like character or someone worse, you're just going to have this sort of horrible cycle of trying to create a government by strong-arming the people and having it collapse, and trying to build a government by strong-arming the people and having it collapse. The only sustainable model for this is for a sustainable structured government to replace what is there because there is nothing there. And again, that's where Ilya and people like Michael Khodorkovsky come in. They're all working to create a functional government for Russia that doesn't oppose the people or repress the people, but invites the people to be part of the government because it's democratic. Again, is it going to be easy? No, but it's not only the best path for us in the West, it's also the best path for the people of Russia. Is it going to be easy for a group of people like Ilya's Constitutional Congress to go in and take power? No. And it may even take a few cycles of other dictators trying to take control. But ultimately, what's going to determine the kind of government and the kind of life that the Russian people have after Putin is going to be what the Russian people do. If they're willing to fight for living in a democracy, they're going to have it. But if they're not willing to fight for it, and this is what an argument that a lot of people make, if they're not willing to fight for it, it's going to get worse.
So when it comes to perhaps worst case scenario, I'm not sure how closely you've been following this, but you know, some of the successors that have been named, if something were to happen, some of these people apparently are extremely anti-West and have made comments about, you know, very aggressive vocal comments about nuking the West, and are aggressive, you know, much more aggressive than perhaps even Putin has been. So that would be basically worst case scenario is someone of that caliber takes over. You know, we don't need to go into those various people, but there, you know, has been reporting about around this. However, Ilya's vision is obviously one for a free and democratic Russia. So let's talk a little bit about what Ilya is working towards. You touched upon this previously about a constitutional Congress, so to speak, and trying to set the stage for a peaceful overthrow or transition of power. So
I never said peaceful.
Okay, well, tell us.
he gets asked this question all the time. The hope would be peaceful, but it's not a guarantee. And I think if he was here, he would say, you know, it may be too late for that. But I think you have to be careful when you talk about that, because first of all, freedom is worth fighting for. So if the choice, I don't believe this is the choice, but if the choice was a peaceful transition to dictatorship or a bloody transition to democracy and freedom, I was ready to go fight for Ukraine. The American people of the 1700s fought for freedom, right? I don't think the right answer is ever, well, dictatorship is easier, so let's do that. I think the right answer is always, I'm going to fight to live a life of freedom. And I hope I hope there's no bloodshed, but there may be. You know, don't forget, you just take a country like Ukraine. They've had two revolutions in the last 30 years. There's been bloodshed. That's part of life, is fighting for what you believe in. So I never said peaceful. Ilya would never say peaceful, other than in the context of hopefully.
So feel free to discuss what is it that he is doing currently.
Sure. So he formed this constitutional convention. Really what they call themselves is the Congress of Deputies of Russia. There are delegates, and this is an interesting thing. All of the delegates to the Congress were elected to office in Russia before 2014. And that's important because since 2014, there have not been legitimate elections. So Putin is not a legitimate leader of Russia. He has to be recognized by the rest of the world as the leader of Russia because he has control. But the West knows that he was not legitimately elected. He just has control of the country and therefore must be treated as the leader. So these were all legitimately elected leaders of Russia. They're delegates of this Congress. They're creating a new government. Sometimes the term government in exile is used. I don't think that's exactly true or exactly correct, because normally that means it's a government that was elected and forced out of the country, like you see in Belarus. But in any case, they're forming a new government. They're writing a new constitution, which when they take power will go to the people to not only change to make appropriate and acceptable to the Russian people, but the Russian people will vote on it. It will be a democratic society, obviously. There will be things codified in new laws like freedom of speech and things like that. And part of why this is important is it's being done transparently. And to the degree that Russians are able to learn about it, they're able to learn that this new government is being formed and who's leading this new government, so that at the time where Putin is gone, they know they do have a choice and that this is an option. One of the parts of this government that Ilya has created is working with others to create, and it's a very important point, and it's a very important point in the book, is they have all agreed as the leadership of this new government that it is an interim government. It is not a forever government. And to guarantee, and that's important, because if people are forming a new government and they think they're going to stay a long time, they make a government perhaps that is designed to serve them and their interests. That's what happened with Yeltsin. You know, if you're the president for years and years and years and you get to create the new government, consciously or unconsciously, you're going to start serving yourself and the people that are important to you. They want to do everything humanly possible to avoid this. And this has been done in other countries as well, where they've written new constitutions. So this is an interim government. The only purpose of this interim government is to get a new constitution written, formalized, and voted on by the people of Russia. By the way, the goal here is not to replace the Russian government. It's to throw it out and start over. This is a completely new country. So the people vote on the new constitution. There's new laws. There's a new judicial system. But the really important point here I want to make is that everyone who's involved in this Congress, who's forming this new government, knows that at the moment there's free and fair elections and a new leader has been elected, you know, say in the next 2 years after this Congress takes power. Up to two years, there's a new election. There's a new democratically elected president. Everyone who is part of that constitutional Congress or Congress knows that they can no longer participate in political life in Russia for the rest of their lives. That's really important. Checks and balances, even in the creation of the government. So I'm not serving on the Congress scheming or angling to be elected president, or scheming and angling to be the head of the Treasury, or scheming and angling to be the head of this or that. I know I'm serving my country for this period to get them to a launching pad. And once my country is now a democracy, I'm done. And I think that is one of the most important things they're doing, because it creates a system where if your goal is to be a lifelong politician, you should not be involved in this effort. Just wait 2 years and run for president.
So that's what Ilya is working towards, and that's what he's heavily involved with other exiled Russians that were, like you said, that were actually elected legitimately. At this point, you know, Putin has rewritten the constitution, allowing him to rule until 2036, so another 13 years out. And that's the same thing that we've seen in China under Xi Jinping, rewriting the constitution as well, for him to extend his reign beyond the two terms for a third term. And again, you can just keep doing that so that you remain in power indefinitely.
If you control everything, you can be democratically elected for as long as you want.
So I guess when it comes to certain outcomes that we could see or scenarios in this year or in the years ahead, one thing that we need to keep in mind is there's that worst case scenario of someone succeeding in Putin's footsteps who's currently in power, that's more aggressive and even more anti-Ukraine, or willing to be more aggressive militarily against Ukraine and even against the West with using its nuclear arsenal. There's been a number of very aggressive remarks made by some of these individuals. You could chalk it up as being just mere rhetoric or not, but that's worst case scenario, especially if they were to follow through on some of the remarks that have been made. Best case scenario, it sounds like, would be if what Ilya is attempting to do with the group of these other exiled Russians to form a free and democratically elected government to essentially have a free Russia.
I'm going to bring up two things. One is, to some degree, I think Putin, there's checks and balances that rule what he's willing to do too. And I think the West has a lot to do with that. He knows that if he crosses certain lines, you know, hell is going to rain over on him. I don't think he cares about the Russian people, but I think he cares about himself. I think if another Putin or someone worse than Putin comes to power in Russia, I think the West is going to respond. I mean, I don't have any inside information or intelligence, but something tells me the West is not just going to sit on its hands and go, oh, what a shame. The West is going to do something. I don't know what that something is, but I bet there's a lot of people in Washington right now that are talking about it and preparing for that possibility. I think the other thing that should not be discounted is I think Putin made an amazingly severe blunder in this invasion that doesn't get talked about a lot. But if you're Russian, you grew up hearing that Ukrainians are inferior. They're dogs. They live like dogs. And we in Russia, we're superior. We live like Russians. So now hundreds of thousands of Russians have gone to Ukraine. Now look, Ukraine, like many countries in the world, has wealth and it has poverty. The wealth is very different than the wealth in Russia, though. And there's also a middle class. And, you know, Russia really only has a middle class in Moscow and St. Petersburg. But Ukraine has a middle class all over the place. So you've been told the Ukrainians live like dogs. And you're suddenly mobilized and sent to Ukraine. And what do you discover? Most Ukrainians don't live like dogs. You wish you lived like a member of the Ukrainian middle class. And they're everywhere. This is a country of people having a wonderful Western middle-class life. And you've been lied to by your government because they told you these people live like dogs and they don't. And if you don't believe me about this, look at how often they steal the toilet seats and the washing machines. You only carry a washing machine back home if you've never had one before and you can't get one. So hundreds of thousands of Russians have gone to Ukraine and discovered they've been lied to about their government. They see how Ukrainians live and think, I don't want to live like a Russian. I want to live like a Ukrainian. And the third part of this that's so important is Russia has very strong arms control, gun control. But suddenly Russia has put guns in hundreds of thousands of people's arms or hands and taught them how to use it or given them some training. What happens when those people go back to Russia? Can you forget that? Or do you tell your family? I was lied to. They don't live like dogs, we do. And oh, by the way, I have a gun and I know how to use it. I think one of the biggest threats to Putin are the soldiers he sent to Ukraine. And if I want to be really cynical about it, he has to have them die in Ukraine. He has to treat them like cannon fodder because he can't afford to have them come home because they'll hunt them down and kill them.
That's very interesting. Yeah. Yeah. And the losses have been pretty heavy. There's one part of this that I do think that we need to touch upon, and this is surrounding the assassination. This was a pretty widely reported event, got a lot of publicity, the assassination of Alexander Dugin's daughter, and where Ilya fits into this. Again, I think this is part of this idea of a peaceful transition of power from dictatorship to a new dictatorship versus one of revolution that requires bloodshed. And this is now, at least this piece of news and where Ilya fits into this does align more with that idea of fighting and doing what it takes in order to overthrow the current power structure. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, the National Republican Army, the assassination, and Ilya's role in that?
Yeah, this book is about a revolution. There's no illusions about it. I mean, the word, I've never searched the text for the word revolution, but that is what it's about. Could it be a peaceful revolution? Yes. May it not be a peaceful revolution? Yes. It'll be what it is until it's a successful revolution. That's what really matters. This could be a very long conversation, and I'll tell you point blank, it's a part of, it's not something I talk with Ilya a lot about because, you know, there's some things that just can't be discussed for security reasons. There's some things, frankly, I don't want to know, to be perfectly honest. But there is a gentleman in Russia named Alexander Dugin, Some people compare him to Karl Rove in his relationship with George Bush, you know, was Bush's brain. Some people have called Dugin Putin's brain. His daughter was his disciple and a well-known TV personality. Very, very pro-Russia. Very, very anti-Ukraine. Very, very pro-invasion. And she was assassinated in her car. Her car was blown up. Some people believe that Alexander Dugin, her father, was the target. They were together, but he had not gotten in the car when it blew up. Some people think both of them were the target. But in any case, it was the first time the group that took responsibility for this was a group that no one had ever heard of before. But that's not exactly true, as I will explain. A group called the National Republican Army took responsibility for this. This is the National Republican Army in Russia. And I want to make clear, she was assassinated by Russians, not Ukrainians. These are Russians. They're called partisans. There's many partisan groups inside of Russia that are revolutionary armies. They have formed.
Russia did say that it was a Ukrainian that had committed that assassination. Yeah,
of course. But these are Russians. They're not the only Russian revolutionary group, but these are Russian groups that are fighting their own country for democracy and the end of Putin. So since the beginning of the invasion, we've heard stories of cars with Zs on them being blown up, Molotov cocktails being thrown through army recruitment offices, government offices, trains blown up, oil processing plants being blown up. Look, this is not Ukraine. Ukraine has enough to do protecting its own territory. It doesn't have the manpower, the resources to go into Russia and start blowing stuff up. These are Russians fighting again, doing the same thing that Ilya's doing. They're not anti-Russia. They're not anti-Russian. They're anti-Putin. They're anti-dictatorships. And so Ilya has a relationship with this group called the National Republican Army. He has a relationship with other of these revolutionary armies. In fact, a week or two after the assassination of Darya Dugina, he brought some of the leaders of these groups to Kyiv and had them sign a collaboration agreement so that they would recognize each other as groups and find ways to work together to be more successful in their opposition to Putin. And I said a few minutes ago that no one had ever heard of the National Republican Army. That's funny to me, because once Darya Dugina was assassinated and the National Republican Army came forward, and in the media, people kept saying, well, we don't really believe that this group exists. It's just a made-up group to maybe somehow pin it back on the Ukrainians or what have you. You know, the media and the Russian government was saying, you know, we never heard of this group before, so we don't believe it actually exists. A light bulb went off in my head. And I thought, well, that's weird. I've heard of this group. Where did I hear of this group? Why would I, a guy in the United States of America, know this group when no one in Russia had ever heard of it? Well, I'll tell you why. Months before the assassination, Ilya wrote about the group in the draft of the book that we were writing together. And I think that's significant, because you don't write in a book about a group that doesn't exist 3 months before it commits an assassination. Obviously, the group existed. It just hadn't become public yet. And he has not in any way apologized for his relationship with these groups, because he understands that in a revolution, blood may need to be shed. And to be shed, you need to have people who are willing to fight. In fact, he encourages the growth of these groups, because to get rid of Putin, if there is going to be blood shed, there's going to be people who are willing to fight.
So after this took place, the National Republican Army had delivered Ilya their manifesto. And so
that's right.
Ilya is basically, he's serving as a communications platform for the National Republican Army. Is that correct?
Well, this is opening up a whole other part of the Ilya story. He, on February 24th, immediately went to join the Ukrainian military. If I have this right, he spent his first night after the invasion standing on a street corner with a machine gun in Kyiv. And in the morning, you know, he did the right thing. He did what any red-blooded Ukrainian should do. Again, not because he's anti-Russia or anti-Russian. He's anti-Putin. He got a call from, I think, a former member of the Ukrainian cabinet and was summoned to a meeting because, again, he has very deep relationships within the Ukrainian government. Why wouldn't they want to, you know, he's pro-Ukrainian and pro-Russian. Why? And he's a former member of the parliament. Why? And a successful business person. Why wouldn't the Ukrainian government want to draw on him in times of peace and times of war? Anyway, he was summoned to a meeting, and part of the meeting was, you know, what could different people do as an offensive move? And he proposed to those at the meeting that he could create an online media channel that would broadcast live on YouTube in Russian news of the Russian invasion back into Russia, so that Russians, using YouTube and Facebook and Telegram and all the other channels, so that Russians could have access to information other than the Kremlin's propaganda. So he created that channel. It's called February Morning, and it's been very, very successful. So when the National Republican Army was forming, I suspect they got to know Ilya, because Ilya's now a member of the Russian media, but an anti-Putin media, and there's no anti-Putin media in Russia. You have to go outside of Russia to find anti-Putin media. I suspect they got to know him because, you know, he is what he is, who he is, his background, his vote against the annexation of Crimea, but he also has a media channel. And so I suspect they gave him the manifesto, not only because he was an ally, but also because he had a platform for distributing it to the rest of the world and to Russians themselves.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So, Greg, you know, I think I've exhausted most of my questions and things that I thought were very interesting. Is there anything that we didn't touch upon that, you know, would be a glaring omission from what's discussed in the book before we close out today's interview?
I just want to say that I believe, and I believe this now more than ever, that this is not a war between Russia and Ukraine. It is a world war. You can see it in how it's affected the world economically, how it's affected the partnerships of countries on both sides. We're all involved in this. And I believe, and I will keep talking about it until there's no longer a conflict there, that the United States and other Western countries need to support Ukraine in every way possible, because we're not only defending them and their land, we're also defending the rest of the West. Russia must fall. Russia must fall under the leadership of Putin. And it's in the best interest of all of us, Russians, Americans, everyone else in the West, to empower the Russian people to fight for a democracy. It will not happen unless they fight for it. And I think it's going to be hard for them to fight for it if they feel like, in the rest of the world's eyes, they're villains. As difficult as it may be for us after almost a year of supporting Ukraine and vilifying Russians, at some point, I think we in the West have to give the Russian people the same feeling of love and support that we've given to the Ukrainians, because it's a very similar battle. In fact, they're fighting the same opponent.
Well, I want to say, you know, there's so many different points of view. There's so many different angles, stories, propaganda that are circulating around the Russian-Ukraine war. And it's important to understand all the different points of view. This is a very, very important one that is told through Ilya Ponomarev. Again, the title of the book is Does Putin Have to Die? The Story of How Russia Becomes a Democracy After Losing to Ukraine. And so, you know, I think it's good to familiarize all of ourselves with all the different points of view that are operating and truly understand what's happening and where this could head. This book describes, hopefully, an optimistic view of where things could go. Again, it may not be peaceful. It may require even more bloodshed and a violent overthrow or revolution. But there are plans being made and there are steps being taken by Ilya and others to try to implement a free Russia, democratically elected, where there is a free press, all the things that he was working towards, not just as an entrepreneur, but also in parliament as well, with all the partnerships with various countries. So that is a brighter future for Russia. So I want to recommend that all of you read the book. But also, Greg, can you tell us, I know that you have ongoing conversations, I believe, live conversations that you do with Ilya. Tell us about some of the other ways in which our listeners can follow more of your work.
Well, the first website I'll send you to is the one for the Congress. Again, it's rusdep.org. That's for Russian Deputy, rusdep.org. Everything posted there obviously is in Russian, but there is English translation. It's really exciting. It's almost like going back and being part of the creation of the United States of America. It's very exciting to see the documents they're working on and debating and then approving amongst themselves. And a large part of their work today is going to other countries, starting obviously with Ukraine and Poland, to find ways for those countries to recognize them as a legitimate part of the Russian nation. I mean, they can't delegitimize Putin while he's in power, but they can recognize another body as well. And that's part of the work they're doing. I do a weekly interview with Ilya for 30 minutes every Thursday at 11 o'clock Eastern on a web platform called Beams. It's BEAMZ. I say I do it every Thursday. There are times where Ilya is not able to make it. Either there's no power, there's no cell service, or he's traveling. But as a general rule, he is able to show up every Thursday at 11 a.m. And we talk about the current situation and the work the Congress is doing for 30 minutes. It's an interactive platform, so people could actually ask questions and he responds to them. That is very easy to find. It's at Beams, beamz.live/doesputinhavetodie.
Greg, thank you for speaking with us about this book on our show, and keep up the great work.
Thank you very much.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.